From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the April 2023 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Communication is key. 80 years ago, Bletchley Park's Communication Centre opened in Block E. Employing hundreds of staff, mainly young women, this block was vital to Bletchley Park's smooth running. Most messages and reports coming in and out of Bletchley Park came through Block E. But as we'll hear in this It Happened Here episode, its wartime importance doesn't necessarily mean its value has been fully recognised today. Block E is still standing and is due to open to the public later this year, 2023, as Bletchley Park's brand new learning centre. Here to help us set the record straight and rediscover the value of Block E is our research officer, Dr. Thomas Cheetham, who's been researching the building and its various departments. Many thanks to Dr. Ben Thompson, Sarah Langston, and Maria Turnbull for voicing our archival documents.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
Tom, tell us what was happening in Block E during World War II and why it was so important.
Okay, so Block E, put simply, is a communication centre. And it opened 80 years ago, so this is why we're talking about it now. Communications at Bletchley Park are something that's, I think it's fair to say, have not been given a lot of attention. And mostly people treat it as a background factor. We know material had to make its way to Bletchley and then make its way out again. Mm-hmm. But people have sort of waved their hand and said, well, it's communications, it goes on in the background, it looks after itself, and it's not that interesting. But of course, it is fundamental to what Bletchley Park does. It only works if intercepts arrive promptly and in large enough number, and they get to the right people, and if the intelligence Bletchley Park is producing also gets to the right people quickly enough for them to act upon it. Mm-hmm. And also, you have to think about internal communications. The various sections of Bletchley do not work in total isolation. They do have to exchange information. And early on in the war, there are problems caused by the fact that doesn't work very well, and later on it gets better, so they all have to liaise with each other, so there's this internal communication going on as well. But we very frequently forget all of this is happening, and we tend to forget communications. We know all about crypto, mm-hmm. and that's our focus, which means we know a little bit about the German communication systems, because these are the factors your cryptanalysts at Bletchley are having to understand to break German codes and ciphers. But we rarely then move on to think about how the Allies are doing exactly the same thing as the Germans. They have their own communications. Every bit is complex. They have their call signs, their frequencies, their discriminants on their wireless networks, all their encipherments, of course. And so point one is to say the Allies are doing this too. Point two is to say for Bletchley Park, it's not only a peripheral part of the Bletchley Park story, it's a big part, I would say. What Bletchley Park becomes is one of the largest communication centres in Britain and probably in the world.
Wow.
Just because of the sheer volume of information which the organisation is processing. From our modern point of view as well, it's also, when we're interpreting what Bletchley Park looks like, it's sort of the most intelligence factory part of Bletchley. It's the most factory-like.
Mm-hmm.
It is sort of highly mechanised, highly formalised in the way it works. There's an overwhelmingly female workforce, so a large chunk of that 75% of people who are female at Bletchley Park are working in communications, and they deserve attention and some recognition for the fact they're working in this generally quite an interesting work and for very long hours and in quite poor conditions a lot of the time.
Mm.
And what's interesting about those communication jobs is they're largely generic. You could be a teleprinter operator anywhere, really.
Mm-hmm.
Any RAF base in the country, but these people are posted to Bletchley Park. And that means these people are in particular obscurity about what they're doing here. And in a lot of cases, they don't even know that Bletchley Park is a code-breaking centre. Mostly they understand it's an intelligence centre or a command centre of some description, but they've got no understanding of the basic function of this place, even less than is usually the case.
So it's just not a glamorous or dramatic job in any way. And these people would have ended their war still feeling that they had a bit of a workaday experience.
Yeah, and none the wiser about what they'd been involved in. But of course, these people are overrepresented among our veterans, overwhelmingly female and on the younger end of the staff body. So we know a lot about their work, and it's something we should talk about more.
And also from the second half of the war as well, if we're talking sort of 1943, 44, 45 as well, a lot of the younger veterans that we have will be coming in those later years.
Yeah, it really booms towards the end of the war. So that's the picture you get.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So what I've been doing recently is doing a bit of work on piecing together the different components of the communication system and the jobs these all do and how they all fit together. And instead of just listing them, the easiest way to approach this subject, certainly in the podcast where I can't show you what's going on, mm-hmm. is to think about what we call the path of a message. Mm-hmm. You were looking at me with a certain amount of skepticism at this stage.
I am. This idea of a single path, of a single type of message is something that we always try and be very wary about when we speak about it.
This idea has reared its head on many occasions in the past. Why don't we show people the path of a message? And of course, the reality is there is not one path. There are many hundreds, if not thousands, of ways a message or a piece of information can make its way through Bletchley Park. Mm-hmm. But it's useful to think about how the traffic is flowing, and that helps us to get our heads around the different systems you have to have in place to handle all of that.
Mm-hmm. So let's start outside of Bletchley Park. Regular listeners will be aware of the Y stations, which were intercepting messages from the airwaves. Those were then noted down by the people who were listening to them. Can you then tell us how those messages came to come to Bletchley Park?
Right, yeah. So the most important point to make here right at the beginning is Bletchley Park does not intercept enemy traffic. Mm-hmm. It is not that sort of radio station. As we will see later, there are radios here, but all will become clear. So everything's intercepted at these Y stations far afield in the UK and around the world. That information all has to get back here. And traditionally, the explanation has been that there were dispatch riders, people with motorbikes,
yes.
and their pannier bags stuffed with messages, riding here all hours of the day, coming in through the gate and delivering the messages.
Which is not untrue at all,
because Bletchley Park is dependent on these dispatch riders at the beginning for most of their traffic, and they're involved throughout the war. The original copies of every piece of traffic are always brought to Bletchley eventually, but later on they're not carrying so much hot material, so much, you know, time-sensitive material. Most of that's being carried by teleprinters. It's a much faster way to get intercepts here, and of course every minute counts when you're breaking enemy codes and ciphers.
Let's dwell on this a minute, because listeners may be very, very familiar with teleprinters. Some of our older listeners may have used them in the past as well. When I first came to Bletchley Park, I did not know what a teleprinter was. And so imagine me wide-eyed on day one, and please explain to us what a teleprinter is.
Okay. I'm told that they were used to announce the football scores on the telly back in the olden days. But again, this is a very long way before my time. A teleprinter is a combination of an electric typewriter and a phone. And so you get two typewriters, you connect them together with a phone line, and then they can talk to each other. When they're connected in this way, what you type into the typewriter at one end of the link appears and is printed out at the other end. So the modern comparison, I suppose, would be with DMs,
okay.
with direct messaging. Mm-hmm. If you're on WhatsApp, you can type in a message and send it, and it will appear instantly at the other end, and the recipient can respond in real time. And you can do this with teleprinters. You can have a conversation over that link. Everything you type in appears instantly at the other end. Mm-hmm. That means you need a cable link, generally.
That cable link is more secure than sending it out through the radio waves as well, isn't it?
Yes. So that when these cables are in the UK, the authorities are happy that the risk of tapping the line is low enough that you can treat that link as secure. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to worry about enciphering that traffic. And this is the main way Bletchley Park is linked with the Y stations and with government, the service ministries, all those intelligence centres, any commands that are in the UK, they're all connected by teleprinter. And so you need a very large number of machines and a very large number of telephone lines to carry all this traffic. Mm-hmm. Now, at the start of the war, when you have only a few teleprinters, of course, like all the machinery here, very expensive and normally in very short supply. So when they only had a few teleprinters, they used them to send in, from the Y stations, they'd use them to send the basic information about the intercepts. Hut 6 that we know a lot about has a system where they would write up what's called a BLIST, short for Bannister List, named after Michael Bannister. All this is a list of all the traffic on a particular cipher key, things like the message indicator, the frequency it's on, the call sign of the sender so you can recognise them, the message discriminants that allow you to recognise what cipher key it's enciphered with, the length of the message, and a few characters of the message, but you don't need the entire message at that point. And what this allows Hut 6 to do is to do a lot of the initial analysis, looking for message repeats, message depths, sillies that we've talked about in other episodes, mm-hmm. before the actual messages arrive in full on their sheets of paper carried by dispatch riders. But later on, the vast majority of the intercepts are arriving by teleprinter, and they build large teleprinter rooms here. So our regular listeners will know that when we opened our D-Day film That's in the old teleprinter building. And that was the first purpose-built building dedicated to teleprinters.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually it housed 72 machines.
It's a lot of machines.
It is a lot of machines. It's not even the biggest teleprinter room on site, though. Even though it is the teleprinter building, it's not the only place there are teleprinters here. There is a teleprinter extension built next door. And initially, that's also single story. And then they put another story on top of it. There are also teleprinter rooms in Block F. And the largest teleprinter room is actually in Block D. So Block D is the block where your sections working on Enigma, which are Hut 6 and Hut 8, go later in the war. And they need a high priority service of Enigma intercepts from the Y stations. So they get their own teleprinter room. It has 78 machines and a system of conveyor belts, which carry messages kind of along the corridor of the spur, which that room is in, and then either going left to Hut 6 or right for Hut 8.
This really is that factory style dealing with information.
So they have all this infrastructure in place.
Yeah.
So they can rip a message off the machine, and tear the message off the teleprinter as it arrives, place it directly on a conveyor, and it's taken immediately and automatically to the section that needs to handle that traffic.
That must have been a racket with 78. Teleprinters aren't quiet machines.
No.
78 of these things, with people having to focus on each machine as well and them constantly. And also they had concrete floors, they had brick walls. I'm presuming they had acoustic tiles on the ceiling, hopefully.
Yeah, it wasn't a very pleasant working environment. It was hot and noisy and pretty intense. And we have a good account from Eileen Gascoigne all about what it was like to work in the main teleprinter room.
We duly arrived for the first session in the teleprinter block, not knowing what to expect. On reflections, I feel sorry for the girls who had never known any other than the park, having gone there straight from radio school. At least we had experience of a working station, so to speak. It was just like walking into a factory, just loads of machines and neon lights which were always going on the blink, which didn't help the eyesight one bit. We were each given a section of machines to look after. All we did all the time we were on duty was walk around keeping watch over the printers that we had been allocated, just signing for the signals, tearing them off, folding them in half and placing them on the conveyor belts to their respective destinations. This we did for the whole of the watches, and then after stand down we were given another section to look after. Boring, boring, boring. All this went on day after day, week after week, month after month.
The reason you need so many machines is so you've got spare capacity for spikes in traffic, because of course every day people fighting the war come onto the airwaves and traffic increases and all that's being picked up and sent back here. So there is a daily spike in traffic. But of course, also if there's a battle going on at a particular theatre, there'll also be a big spike in traffic. And we know, for example, after D-Day, the traffic increases enormously because all of a sudden the Germans are thrown into disarray. They're not able to use their landlines. They've been bombed a lot of the time. They're moving around. They have to rely on their radios. There's a lot more traffic to deal with. And the teleprinter rooms need to be able to absorb this. And that means some of the time it would have been quite boring and some of the times it would have been very intense. What these workers are doing in these teleprinter rooms, and they're almost all Women's Auxiliary Air Force, WAFs, who are involved in this work. The RAF are generally in charge of communications at Bletchley because they have the expertise. And so most of your communication staff are WAFs. What they're doing is supervising a few machines, waiting for them to spit out a message and tearing them off, logging them, making sure there aren't any errors in the way that's been recorded, and dealing with any technical issues, but then placing those messages mostly on a conveyor belt or in a box in a particular tray for them to be sent on to the recipient. The problem is this is really dull work, and these WAFs have been trained to operate teleprinters, not just receiving messages, but sending messages. But most of the time at Bletchley, they're just receiving. They're just waiting for a message to come out of the machine, and then they're placing it on a conveyor belt. It's not the most interesting work. It doesn't give them a chance to exercise the skills they've learned in their training. So they're not the happiest workers at Bletchley Park, we might say. We have a good description of the work that went on in the main teleprinter room, written by H.H. Laurie, Wing Commander Laurie, who was in charge of the main Women's Auxiliary Air Force teleprinter section.
It consists of a large room and annex containing a total of 72 teleprinters, engaged almost entirely in the receipt of intelligence information. Each operator is required to keep a watch on a varying number of machines and detect and rectify the fairly prevalent paper feed troubles. In addition, She has to scrutinize each received message for obvious errors, overprinting, etc., insert corrections, prepare signal for delivery to addressee, record the receipt, retain and file one copy, and deliver the remainder to the appropriate one or two dispatch points. The number of machines one operator can manage varies with the incidence of traffic, but experience has shown that in this room, one operator can average 5 machines. Supervision has to be continuous, so that the staff can be reallocated efficiently to meet rapidly changing conditions, and also prevent accumulation of traffic by operators who try and avoid continuous walking.
So we've looked at information in, intercepts, etc. But what about information out? Bletchley Park needed to send intelligence reports out to customers and so on. Was that done by teleprinter as well?
Yeah, mostly it was. But the confusion is that the routes are slightly different. The most logical way to organise things would be to have one teleprinter room that handles everything, incoming and outgoing. But the problem is, this is what they try and initially do, but the problem is only get backlogs. When you've got a spike of traffic coming in, there are fewer teleprinters for traffic going out. And the situation is you normally have quite a consistent flow of traffic going out at quite a low level. So it's very predictable. And that means you can get away with using fewer machines, and therefore you don't need so much space for them, so you can put them in the sections producing that intelligence. And you can wire them up directly to the customers of whatever section that is. So Hutfree, when it's sending information out, it needs to go to Windy Ridge, which is a radio station sending it out to the special liaison units for information going to commanders in the field. It needs to talk to the War Office, the Air Ministry and the Admiralty, and a few major commands and MI6 headquarters, but that's pretty much it. So you can get away with having only maybe 6 or 8 machines in Hutfree for outgoing traffic. That system turns out to be more efficient. So in addition to these big central teleprinter rooms, mostly handling incoming traffic, you also have lots of small ones in each of these sections taking most of the outgoing traffic. And in those sections, they tend to run their own teleprinter rooms. It could be WAF, but also REN or civilian staff operating those machines, depending on the section. And the work there is a bit more interesting because they tend to be sending plain language material so they can read what they're sending and they know its intelligence and they can see how important it must be to the recipient. But again, working conditions could be pretty awful. We've got a really good account from room 16 in the teleprinter extension, which is upstairs where our archival reading room is now, actually. This is a room from which they manage cable links to Washington. When they're breaking Japanese traffic in Naval Section, for example, that's being forwarded to the Naval Codebreakers in Washington, and that's all going through this room 16 in the teleprinter extension. But they've got far too many machines and far too many people in far too small a space.
Flight very nearly had hysterics tonight over working conditions in room 16. Can anything be done to drive home to Squadron Leader Richards that things are getting pretty desperate? The chief complaints are obvious. Terrible lack of air, abundance of noise, perforator operators banging elbows as machines are too close, not sufficient room for two to work, in all nowhere to put anything and no room to move. The headache incidence has risen sharply this tour, and I am wondering if we could get some aspirin from the quartermaster as private supplies are running low. I can feel quite frankly that efficiency curve is down because extra efforts are frustrated by conditions. It is pointed out that these conditions prevail when we are busy, but definitely not working to capacity. I pass this to you for whatever action you think, because I am very unhappy indeed about the matter.
It strikes me that with this huge amount of teleprinter traffic, what you said in the past about the phone line connections to Bletchley Park being one of the really key reasons as to why this site was chosen, it really does strike me as that must have been a huge amount of constant communications traffic on the wires between Bletchley and the various places that those messages were going out to.
Yeah, it's an enormous amount. I don't know the full volume of actual traffic being sent, but I can tell you that by the end of the war in Europe, there were 246 teleprinter circuits in use.
Wow.
So individual telephone lines.
Blimey.
From all parts of Bletchley Park, connecting them to pretty much everywhere that mattered, both in the UK and around the world.
Phone line heaven.
This is why the contribution of the engineers, the GPO staff running all those lines is so important. And of course, the many hundreds of people managing all those teleprinters.
That must mean that everything arriving and leaving Bletchley Park was surely done by teleprinter.
Not quite. There is one big exception to this, and this is something called the auto room, which has an interesting name, but very few people have, I think, got their head around what it actually does. So I'm going to attempt to explain.
Please tell
here.
Us, yeah.
So what very few people know is that Bletchley Park is actually a radio station. But I say again, yeah. It is not a Y station.
Okay.
So it is not a radio station for intercepting enemy traffic.
Mm-hmm.
It is a radio station that's part of a British radio system.
Ah, okay.
The purpose of this radio network is to carry intercepted messages from overseas, because that's where many of these Y stations are. That's where a lot of the war is happening.
Mm-hmm.
So you're intercepting traffic out in the Mediterranean or North Africa or in Southeast Asia. But getting all that material back to Bletchley, back to Britain at all, is very difficult. There are cable links to these places,
mm-hmm.
but they're always in danger of being cut, and they're always overloaded with the normal sort of command traffic you need to run the war. So there isn't a lot of bandwidth left, literally, for signals intelligence-related communications. And during about 1941, you know, the war is getting bigger and getting more global. The British are trying to increase their interception resources out in these far-flung parts of the world. But there's no point intercepting more traffic out there unless you can get it back to the UK.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you do that? You build an entirely new radio network from the ground up just for intercepts. And this is what the auto room is part of. Again, this task is given to the RAF because they're the communications experts. And this system uses what we refer to as high-speed Morse. And it's also known as the Wheatstone system because it's invented by Charles Wheatstone in the middle of the 19th century. Charles Wheatstone may be known to some of our listeners for inventing the Playfair cipher, which has a part in the Bletchley Park story. But he also does a lot of work in telegraphy. And he works out a way to record Morse code messages on a paper tape and then transmit them automatically via cable. But by the end of the 19th century, and certainly by the 1940s, it's quite straightforward to do this by radio as well. And so the process goes like this. You intercept your traffic,
right,
written down by hand by your intercept operator.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else then punches it onto Morse tape.
What does that look like?
With holes in it.
Okay.
People may have heard of teleprinter tape.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a different type of tape here, but a similar principle in that the position of the holes on the tape tells your machinery what signal to send, so you can translate your messages into Morse code in this case.
Okay.
So your intercepted traffic is now punched onto tape, then it's fed through the machinery through a device called an auto head, which reads the tape at a high speed and sends it as dots and dashes, but far faster than any human being could manage. There's a radio station with aerials about 3 miles south of Bletchley Park at RAF Stoke Hammond, and that picks up these transmissions. And Stoke Hammond is connected by cable to one of the wings of Block E inside the park, which is the auto room. And that is where the messages emerge from the machinery there. And they emerge in a different format, no longer as holes in tape, but as a wavy line on a tape, a bit like a seismograph. If you imagine an ink needle making a wavy line.
On a bit of ticker tape.
On a bit of ticker tape, exactly.
Right.
And that's known as Morse slip, produced by a device called an undulator. Lots of nice terminology in this area. And what all this technology means is you can use one radio link to carry a lot of traffic. If you keep feeding it with pre-punched messages, you can deliver a lot of traffic in a very short space of time compared to doing it all manually. But of course, to make that system work, what you need is lots of people punching up messages and then deciphering them at the other end from the Morse slip. So what you've done with this system is you've substituted a resource which is cheap and plentiful, which is manpower, mostly woman power, for expensive resources like aerials, technical personnel to manage radio links, radio frequencies, because they're always congested.
This high-speed Morse system, was Bletchley Park and the intercept stations the only people using this? Was it a specific to the Bletchley Park system?
Well, there are high-speed Morse networks used by most countries
mm-hmm.
for all sorts of traffic during the war. The Germans use high-speed Morse, the British use it for their command networks, and the RAF have, there are separate high-speed systems for the RAF's normal traffic. And there are also, of course, high-speed teleprinter networks.
Mm.
We know about the Lorenz system used by the Germans broken at Bletchley Park.
Mm-hmm.
So again, there are lots of parallels here between what different people are doing. So they set this whole new network up. It becomes operational from about March 1943, which is when Block E opens. So they need all the equipment in place installed in the building before it will work. But once these aerials come online, they carry a lot of traffic. It's a bit late to help out with the war in North Africa. As always, things move a little bit too late for the purpose for which they're intended. Mm-hmm. But the war in the Mediterranean goes on, of course, to the end of the war. So there's lots of traffic coming back from Egypt and all the Japanese material coming back from the major Y stations in Colombo are also really, really important. And the amount of traffic being carried by this network goes up to about 400,000 cipher groups per day, which is about as much traffic again. I said the RAF have its own high-speed networks. This is about as much traffic again, just for signals intelligence purposes, just for getting intercepts back from various points around the world, back to Bletchley Park for deciphering.
You said 400,000 cipher groups per day. Just explain, what's a cipher group?
Yeah, so our listeners may know that Enigma traffic is sent in five-letter groups, and that's pretty standard. That's not unique to Enigma. You send your traffic in groups, especially when it's in cipher, to conceal the pattern of a message, but also you've got consistent amounts of text to work with. What these cipher groups do is provide a consistent unit by which you can measure the amount of traffic you're handling. It doesn't matter if you're sending a message with lots of big long words or lots of very short ones, you can count them by the same unit. So they normally count their traffic just for convenience according to the number of groups that they're processing.
This Morse slip that is being used for receiving this message, this wiggly line on a bit of ticker tape, arrives at Bletchley Park. Now, when we're talking about intercepted messages, in my mind, I think of the red messages and the five-letter groups written down at the Y stations and put in the bag and sent over here, something you can actually read. It might read like gibberish, but you can see the letters. This wiggly line tape, what was done to it so that it could be converted into something usable?
Yeah, so this being able to interpret what's written on that undulator tape is the job of the WAFs in the auto room. That's their chief skill.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they're termed wireless operator Morse slip readers.
Catchy
job
title.
They can read Morse slip.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have all the skills they need to operate the radio equipment. So they're highly trained. They're a cut above those teleprinter WAFs, even though they're experts in their own field. But these wireless operator Morse slip readers, they complete their basic training when they're joining the WAF. Then they do 6 months training as wireless operators. Then they do another 6 months on top of that, just to learn how to read the Morse slip, which is quite difficult to do, and not everyone could do it. Normally, people who understand Morse code, you do it by listening to the rhythm of the sound you're hearing in your headphones. You don't really read it. You don't recognize the characters and imagine the characters. You just feel the rhythm of it. But when you're reading it off a Morse slip, you do have to read it. So you have to unlearn your basic understanding of Morse, and you have to relearn how to read it and recognize the actual pattern of dots and dashes that you're seeing. And then you have to learn to do this at high enough speed to process a large amount of traffic while typing at the same time. Touch typing, because you can't look at the keyboard.
Goodness.
They have these devices which keep the Morse slip scrolling past at a constant speed. So you fit this up and set it going, and then you just type away.
That sounds so high pressure as well. If you miss it, you're stuffed.
Yes. And again, just a reminder, this is unreadable gibberish, and you don't quite understand the ramifications, but you know that if you get a character wrong, it will cause problems. So they have to have absolute accuracy.
Wow.
It's really skillful work. So when you look at a piece of Morse slip, you have peaks and troughs in your wavy line, and the long peaks are the dashes and the short peaks are the dots. And it's as simple as that.
So they're literally reading off dot dash in their minds and then instantly converting that to letters. They can't be thinking in terms of words. As you say, if it's gibberish, they're not making up words. They're just going letter by letter by letter.
It's a very mechanical, automatic process that you learn. You kind of train your brain to do it after a while, but it takes a lot of practice.
How long were these shifts they had to do this for?
Like most people at Bletchley Park, 8 hours with a break in the middle.
Wow.
But it would have been very tiring and very mentally draining.
Mm.
What all of this training and the skill means is there was more of an esprit de corps in this section than among other communications sections, because they knew they were good at what they were doing. And a lot of the time, because they literally had their fingers on the radio dial, tuning into these stations around the world, whether they're in Egypt or Colombo or Canada, Australia, places like this, they had a relationship with the people they were in touch with, and they felt a better connection to the wider war effort. And you can see that come through in their accounts, that they understood what they were doing was important.
I suppose they aren't listening to the enemy, they're talking to allies.
Yes, exactly. So they feel plugged into what's going on around the world. A lot of what we know about work in the auto room comes from a veteran called Doreen Luke, who worked there. She wrote a book about it, and she deserves a lot of credit, actually, for telling us a lot of detail about her particular part of the picture. She could have easily been put off by deciding that it was maybe not the most important job here, but she wasn't discouraged. She wrote it all down for us, and now we have a much better understanding of what the work involved. And we just have a section here, her describing how she learnt to do the slip reading work.
It is quite easy to type listening to Morse, which we also had to do, and is much quicker than writing it down. But to read it was a different affair altogether. We learned Morse listening to it over the air by rhythm, rather than remembering or picturing dots and dashes. Well, now we had to regress and recognise the dots and dashes as letters and figures. I was very prone to a habit called transposition, which was reversing my letters and figures. Thinking ahead of my hands, my coordination wasn't very good, and I had to work very hard to correct this discoordination of hand and eye. I knew if I didn't correct it, I would not pass the course. So I worked very hard at it, slowing down my brain, speeding up my hands.
Following this path of a message that we were talking about earlier, the WAFs have taken this undulator, Morse slip, and converted it into letters. So they can now send this over to the cryptanalysts to decipher the enemy encryption and the message can be read. Is this correct?
Not quite. There is yet another layer to this particular onion.
This long path of the message.
Indeed. So these messages have arrived at Bletchley Park by radio, and therefore they've been on the airwaves, and it must be assumed the enemy are trying to intercept them. Therefore, they have to be enciphered.
So the enemy are trying to intercept the messages, which are made up of the enemy's own intercepted messages.
Yes, and if they see lots of their own messages flooding back to Britain in enormous numbers at 400,000 cipher groups a day,
the jig is up.
They're going to think something's up.
Mm-hmm.
So everything is enciphered, so that this looks like a normal radio network for something the Germans aren't overtly interested in. And so we've got several layers here. We've got the Allies intercepting Axis enciphered messages and sending them back to Britain. So we have presumably people in Italy or Germany picking up these high-speed Morse messages. So they're intercepting Allied enciphered, Axis enciphered messages.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're sending them back to their own HQ by radio, then you have people in Britain picking up Axis enciphered, Allied enciphered, Axis enciphered messages. And presumably it goes on and gets a bit silly. And at this point, your brain starts to spin.
Yes, I'm losing you, Tom. I'm losing you.
But the point is, just like the German communications that go onto the airwaves have to be enciphered, so do the Allied ones.
Mm-hmm.
All this stuff has to be deciphered once it arrives at Bletchley Park to reveal the original enemy message, which can then go to the cryptanalysts to have the enemy cipher removed. Are you still with me?
I am, yes.
Fantastic.
So basically, you never want to send anything over the airwaves that somebody else can intercept and immediately tell what it is.
Exactly.
Right.
So this traffic is all being enciphered on the British equivalent of Enigma, which is called Typex. And so you need Typex machines at Bletchley to do the decipherment of the material that's arriving here. And these are all in another section, which is based in Block E, a civilian section this time, known as the Cipher Office. And as the name suggests, they deal with ciphers.
And they're taking off that British layer of Typex encipherment, right?
Absolutely. Now, Typex is best known at Bletchley Park for its use in the sections breaking Enigma, because it could be rewired to emulate Enigma, to be an Enigma analogue. And therefore, if you set up your adapted Typex machine correctly, you can use it to decipher Enigma messages.
Because mm-hmm. It's a rotor machine as well, like Enigma is.
Yeah, it works on exactly the same principle. It's basically a copy of the Enigma with some additional features added. But actually, most Typex at Bletchley Park are not used for decoding enemy messages. They're used for deciphering British messages
mm-hmm.
in this way, in the cipher office. But the cipher office does start off very small because they are, again, very short on machines. The advantage of Typex is that it has these two printers on it, so it produces a permanent output. It's not like Enigma where you just get a lamp lighting up and then you have to write the letter down. You get a printed output. That's incredibly convenient as a record, but it means the machines are big, heavy, and complex and expensive, and they break all the time. So they're always short on machines. So the cipher office only starts with a handful. By mid to late point in the war, they've got about 60 machines. So it's far more than HUT 6 or HUT 8 have for decoding Enigma traffic. And they're processing something like 500,000 cipher groups every day.
Wow.
That demand is there from quite an early point. There is a point in the war before the cipher office has reached its full size, before that high-speed Morse network feeding to the auto room has been set up. Even at that point, there is still too much traffic arriving from the Middle East for the cipher office to decrypt. And in January 1942, they actually have a backlog of over 1 million cipher groups and they destroy them because they think we're never going to get to the bottom of this backlog.
Mm-hmm.
So they just chuck that traffic in the bin and they start from scratch.
Wow.
On up-to-date traffic. But by the end of the war, they're able to get through the massive amounts of information that they need to process. So if you think about what they're actually doing on a day-to-day basis, they've got the machine in front of them. These are civilian workers. They are mostly what they call directed. So they have been given the choice of going into war industry, joining the women's services, or a job at the Foreign Office that we can't tell you the details of, but it's an office job. So maybe it's more comfortable than working in a factory.
And it might sound really interesting.
It might be something, yeah, wow. Or at least something comfortable. Mm-hmm. But they arrive at Bletchley Park and they find it's not so much.
No.
I say they've got this machine in front of them. They're operating it. British enciphered material is going in. German or Italian or Japanese enciphered material is coming out. So what they're doing is turning gibberish into different gibberish.
So they have a sheet of paper in front of them, almost like a typewriter, and they're typing in what they see in front of them. And it's getting spat out on a strip of paper.
Exactly, on a strip of paper. They do actually train a certain number of staff in the cipher office again to do that more slip reading so they can take one stage of the process out. And they take the more slip direct from the auto room and read off it. But they are turning gibberish into gibberish. So there's no interest in the work whatsoever. They've got no idea what the material is that they're handling. It just looks like they're at a communication centre and they're dealing with communications. I suppose if the staff did think about it and if they had maybe a technical background, they would be able to guess at the fact there is cryptanalysis involved. But I think in many cases, these workers, even though it's quite obvious to us, maybe what's going on for many of these workers, they don't have that technical background. They're straight out of school. They're young women who really haven't been taught anything about engineering or science. These are not female subjects at the time.
And this is not revealed to them as well.
No, and then told nothing.
Wow.
So I think very few of them would have had even a guess at what they were involved with. A lot of these are local workers. They're recruited from the local area because they're available, and the fact that they haven't been able to find a better paying job indicates they're not the highest caliber workers. Few qualifications are required for this work. You just need to be able to type. Anyone can learn how to do it.
That's no small skill. No,
it takes practice. But again, these are not the same sort of people you're getting from the universities who are going and being recruited specifically from around the country. So many of these people are from just down the road. They're on the lowest pay of anyone at Bletchley. They don't really get a lot of training. The training mostly involves being sat at a desk and told to get on with it and learning on the job. They're not as well looked after as the uniformed staff because they're placed in private billets. By the mid to late point in the war, they are really scraping the bottom of the barrel as far as billets go. And they're being put in these quite dingy railway cottages, which are not very pleasant with, you know, no modern facilities to speak of.
Mm-hmm.
No running water, privy at the end of the garden, a bath in the tub in the kitchen, if you're lucky, once a week.
And they're living with other families as well.
And with these civilian families who often aren't very welcoming. Sometimes they look after them really well, but sometimes the billeters are frankly neglectful. And it's a bit of a lottery about what situation you're going to end up in. Obviously long hours like everyone at Bletchley. The machine itself is a real pain to operate, the Typex. It's very unergonomic. You have to sit at a high angle with your back very straight. You have to push down on the keys very hard. So it puts a lot of strain on your back, on your fingers, obviously, and your hands. On your eyes, because you're reading off this small type for hours on end every day. You're having to set up the machine, which is hard to do by hand. You're often having to use a pencil or a piece of wood to move the components of the machine. And this, you end up getting oil or things like Vaseline on your hands, things that are used to lubricate the machine. And then you have to go and wash your hands afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you have, I think, is fair to describe as a perfect storm of factors which are bad for morale.
Yeah, sounds so disheartening.
Now, it's not fair to say that the cipher office is the only place which is nasty to work at Bletchley. But we have particularly good evidence about what it's like to work there because it is a major concern during the war. The managers at the top are looking at high rates of absence and high staff turnover. They see this as a problem and they're trying to get to the bottom of what's going on. And a lot of that correspondence survives. And this is why we know about how difficult a place it was to work.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, we've got a letter from Alan Bradshaw, who we've talked about in the past, who's the administrative chief at Bletchley.
I have for some time been perturbed at the sickness rate in White's section, which stands at a fairly consistent level of from 6 to 7%. This is rather more than double the ordinary sickness rate for female staff in the rest of the park. We change the girls' jobs round so that they do not always operate the machines, which is considered to be the tiring side of the work, but do their turn of sitting down and clerical work. At the same time, we have introduced music while you work, with a view to easing strain. The figure, however, of sickness remains obstinately at the same level. It must be granted that the work is difficult in that the girls are reading from undulator slip, and at the same time handling a rather tricky machine, the working of which requires great accuracy. The operation of the machine is slower approximately by one half than the operation of an ordinary typewriter. And to do this rather slow motion for 8 hours at a stretch cannot be anything but tiring. But on the other hand, it should not be more tiring than many jobs in factories. The premises are a vast improvement on the conditions in the huts, but have not made any difference in the sickness rate. Therefore, only two things are left which I can think of. The seating, which may not provide the proper support to the operators' backs, and the ventilation, which may not be adequate, especially after blackout hours.
We've said in the past that the Bletchley Park management took an interest in the welfare of the people working here. And we've spoken about free time activities that were supported and welfare benefits, I suppose, in order to improve the quality of life for the people working at Bletchley Park. Was this the same with these women in this section? Were there efforts made at least to alleviate some of this?
Well, there were efforts made, but I think the impression we get generally is that the attitude is pretty unenlightened. You can see this actually from a document which is submitted to the management, which is a list of the medical complaints which have caused staff to go off work, including things like rheumatism, gastritis, eye strain causing severe headaches, anxiety state, nervous debility, nervous breakdown, and psychoneurotic. So you can see some of that terminology is not exactly modern, and it doesn't show a very enlightened attitude towards things like mental health and to morale in general. So when the management start looking into what's going on in the Cypher office, they're looking into functional factors like poor ventilation. They did have ventilation problems, and they had problems with the heating being on full blast in the middle of the summer and just being very hot and stuffy. And a lot of this correspondence goes back and forth about these very functional issues. They do send in also Captain Melrose, who's the chief medical officer, and he does discuss morale as a problem, but he's pretty unsympathetic. He says, "I do not agree that poor ventilation is the reason for the morale problems, but that the cause is due to the morale of the section." But he also says, "I've checked over the types of sickness and the majority appear to be of the trivial nervous debility type. I suggest these girls are talked to and reminded they're doing war work and must be willing to put up with some discomfort. Certificates excusing night work should be absolutely ignored because it is no greater hardship working at night than during the day."
Well, he sounds like a charmer.
He does. And frankly, a little bit out of touch, if you can say that working at night is no different to working in the day. There are more enlightened voices in this conversation, and one of them is from the chair of the Women's Committee, who is a Jarrah Wickham, who Bradshaw sends to visit the section one day. And again, we have her report on what she found when she visited.
"I spent the evening of Saturday, the 20th of November, in Block E. Ventilation was not good and the atmosphere was heavy. The question of morale is a difficult one to answer in writing. I found the girls friendly and obviously glad to have someone from outside interested in what they were doing, provided the initiative came from me. I felt a tremendous lack of any kind of personal touch in this large and rather unwieldy section. And I know, with large numbers and everybody very busy, that it must be one of the first things to be overlooked. But, at the same time, if there were somebody who was really interested in these girls, I am sure that morale would improve considerably. It would be a full-time job for the right person, whoever that may be. I do not wish to cast aspersions on the present regime, but at the same time, I feel that probably, because it is rushed and busy, there is no time to give the personal touch to the staff which it requires, particularly as most of it is doing such concentrated and repetitive work and can see so little result for their pains."
So what Wickham identifies is these women working here, they just need a bit of recognition. They need somebody looking out for their welfare and their happiness in the workplace. And that's absent. And the veterans do tell us they rarely saw any of the managers, who were probably far too busy doing other things to worry about what their workers were thinking about. And that's a point that Wickham makes, but she does recognise the fact that they need someone to look after them. So there is this discussion about appointing a women's supervisor. It's unclear whether that actually ever happens and whether things really do improve. What we do know is this is one of the places where they resort to what they refer to as factory methods to guarantee efficiency. So everything is logged and monitored to identify efficiencies down to the level of an individual staff member. And Nigel de Grey, one of the senior managers, writes a report just after the end of the war, and is obviously very interested in how this has all been done and gives us a really good description of the sort of arrangements which are put in place in the Cypher office.
The problem of output was a new one, and serious. Owing to demands made irregularly for raw material to be sent by wireless, traffic was apt to peak without proper warning. Consequently, there were heavy arrears with which improvised methods could only partially cope. Labour use was directed, and the interest nil. It became necessary to intervene and institute factory methods. This was done chiefly by keeping careful records of output per watch, per machine, and per girl. This showed up weaknesses, peak hours, etc., and enabled the manager to adjust numbers and skill per watch, additional training for slow workers, and additional servicing of machines. Drum and insert settings were kept ready-made up at a stall, and the operator drew a ready-made set, so saving operators time. Properly constructed chairs were found to minimize fatigue and increase output, but were seldom available. Drum maintenance done at the stall increased the life of drums. The actual capacity being known, loads could be kept within bounds, and supply of additional girls and machines calculated to meet future needs.
Now, in the end, the Cypher office does work. It does process all the traffic it needs to process. It's a functional part of the communication system. And Nigel de Grey also writes that on the whole, the office reached a high rate of efficiency, taking everything into account. But I think you can see the implication there. What he's thinking about when he says taking everything into account is those personnel management problems that they have here. And I don't think there's a lot of evidence they ever really get on top of those.
That everything into account is quite heavily laden, isn't it?
Indeed.
Quite mysterious. So this use of radio for communications, there's material information going out from Bletchley Park via radio as well. Is that enciphered by the Cypher office too?
Yes, so that needs to be enciphered too. We've talked in the past about the special communication units and special liaison units, which handle material going out to commanders in the field. And everything they're receiving is by radio, so it's enciphered. And in that case, it's even more important because this is plain language, decrypted German messages. There will be a complete giveaway if any of these manage to leak to the Germans. So security needs to be absolutely watertight. And they use two systems for this. They either use what's called one-time pad. This is basically a manual system of enciphering. And the thing with one-time pad is it's technically unbreakable if done properly because you only use the cipher once and never again. So there's no repeats in the cipher which an attacker can use to work out how it's constructed.
Is that quite a time-consuming method of enciphering something, though?
Yes. So they use one-time pad for higher security at special communication units and special liaison units which are closer to the front lines. And otherwise, they're using Typex again. And when it's Typex, it has to come back to the Cypher office because there isn't space in Hut 3 to do the Typex work over there. They have a special room in the Cypher office in Block E. It's known as the Leonard room because they have code words for the various cipher keys, just like the Germans have lots of cipher keys, the British have lots of cipher keys. They have a specific cipher key for ultra traffic going out to commanders. That is called Leonard.
Why
is
it? Do we
presumably know? Presumably, it's L in the alphabet.
Ah, okay.
I know they have a key called George as well and a few others, but presumably key Abel or key Bertie had gone out of use at some point. So they have the Leonard room where stuff is enciphered for leaving the park. And again, it's slightly more interesting work because staff in that room can read the messages and get an appreciation of the contribution they're making to the war.
That's so true. They're actually seeing what the commanders or their staff out there will be seeing as well.
They're reading exactly the same ultra that's gone through Hut 3 that all the intelligence officers over there who know everything there is to know about the German army are able to read as well.
That's strikingly different to people in the same building who are converting gibberish to gibberish all day long.
Yeah.
Goodness.
It makes it a lot more fulfilling. And we've got a good account from Joan Ireland, who worked in that room, about the difference there.
When you were a grade 3 clerk or a grade 2, you typed the 5-letter groups and they came out as 5-letter groups, another sort.
So you couldn't, they meant nothing to you.
They're absolutely boring. Yeah. And all you did was these 5-letter groups. But when you got to the Leonard room, which I did most of the time, I think, you typed what the, I say big wigs, which you'll know what I mean.
Yeah.
I don't think Churchill actually gave it, but, you know, and it was all about moving troops from A to B and whether ships You see, that snag was, as far as we girls were concerned, there were about 10 machines in that Leonard room, and there were about 8 girls. Well, you only did on one shift 1/8 of the typing, but then you only did 1/3 of the day, you see.
Of course, yeah.
So you got a bit of that and a bit of that. And you could tell whether a ship had been sunk in the Norwegian field.
Yeah. Well, whose ships were they talking about? The Allied ships or the enemy ships?
Both.
Both, right, okay.
Just information.
Yeah, just general information.
Above, yes.
Yes. And can I ask, why was it called the Leonard Room?
The messages were called Leonard.
Oh.
There were George messages and Leonard messages.
Oh.
There were Leonard messages were the thing.
Yes.
The next one down was George.
So it's just like a code word.
And, I mean, it was terribly, terribly important that these things went, you know, it was pain of death that you kept them waiting a minute.
Mm.
And when it was about 11:30 or something, there were some girls somewhere here that did the logging in and out, and they come in and they say, there's a message coming through at 5Z. Is anybody ready? Because you had to change the code at 12 o'clock. You couldn't do yesterday's code if the message came in at 12:05.
And 5Z meant it was very,
very
priority.
Very important. Just did it, you know. Somebody had to be waiting to do it. Somebody had to be waiting to stick it up for you.
So it was a very responsible job you were doing.
Yes. There's no question about it. I remember one sad occasion. A girl was sitting, typing away, you know, middle of the night or 2 a.m. or something. And all of a sudden she burst out crying. And she typed the name of her fiancé's regiment. And then underneath she typed heavy losses.
Oh, no.
And she just couldn't go on with it. But that was the sort of, you know, the information you got. It was rather nerve-wracking, you know.
I understand, yeah.
It was also nerve-wracking to know that you knew what you knew.
Another job the Cipher Office does, in keeping with the fact it controls all the encipherment, is that it's responsible for enciphered transatlantic communications to Washington. I talked a bit about the cable section earlier, but some of these links are even more secure, and they're also enciphered, presumably to protect against either nefarious people in the cable offices in New York or Washington, perhaps, or maybe if the Germans manage to get a ship out into the Atlantic and tap the cables physically. So these are communications with places like British Security Coordination in the Rockefeller Center in New York, or really secure high-level communications with the commanders in Washington. And they're protected by machines which are pretty unusual for the time. They have one called the Combined Cipher Machine, CCM.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very clever system where engineers in the States are able to create attachments for the Typex and for the American equivalent rotor-based cipher machine, which is called SIGABA, or the ECM, the electronic cipher machine. And this attachment basically makes Typex and ECM interoperable. So they look completely different, but they operate exactly the same and they can communicate with each other. And the Cipher Office has the CCMs adapted from Typex, but also the version based on the American machine, which is really unusual because the Americans are so careful with their cipher machines. They never let the British anywhere near an ECM that hasn't been modified. And even now, we don't know the wirings of that machine. It's still classified. But they give a certain number, which have been adapted in this way, they give them to the Cipher Office at Bletchley Park because they can't get enough Typex machines and they need that communication link working at higher efficiency. They also have a machine called ROCX. This is what's called a one-time tape machine. So on exactly the same principle as a one-time pad, you can encipher a teleprinter message by combining it with a cipher tape, which you only use once. And as long as you only use that tape once, it should be unbreakable. And the machine takes the message you're sending and the cipher tape and combines the two automatically and then does a decryption at the other end, a bit like the Lorenz machine, if our listeners are familiar with that machine. And that's completely cutting edge. There's only a handful of ROCX machines in the world when they're operational here.
These amazing sounding machines, are these in what I've heard called Mr. White's secret wing?
Yes, they are. That's what we normally tend to call it. I think officially it's called the secret cable room, but the terminology, as usual, is a bit iffy and unclear.
I also like Mr. White's secret wing has an air of mystery about it.
Yeah. And it attests to how personal this operation is. It's under a man called Alfred Sidney White. We know quite a bit about him because actually one of our volunteers is his granddaughter, Caroline Johnson. And I was able to sit down with her and have a chat about her grandfather. So Caroline, thank you so much for talking with us today about your grandfather, who was Alfred Sidney White, who was head of the Cipher Office. Can you tell us a bit about him?
Yes, certainly. He was a larger-than-life character, strong personality, had a real determination to excel. He was a staunch Salvation Armyist and later in life would regularly preach on Sundays. As a boy, he was gifted in mathematics and was awarded a scholarship to the local independent school of Bedford Modern. In later years, a bank manager at Barclays in Margate in Kent. And he was a leading light in the local community and was involved in a number of local charities like Oxfam and the local Royal Sea Bathing Hospital in Margate.
So he wasn't always in Margate, though, was he? This was after the war. And of course, before the war, he's actually in Bletchley, isn't he?
Yes, that's right. He was in Bletchley in the local bank. He was clerk in charge of the local sub-branch of Barclays Bank in Bletchley. And Sir Edward Travis, who was later to be head of Bletchley Park, was a customer. And one day when he went into the bank, my grandfather said, "You will have to go to the neighbouring branch in Fenny Stratford because I have to close this branch for the duration, as I've been called up as an accounting officer in the RAF." And Sir Edward Travis said, "Would you like to come and work for me instead?" So my grandfather started working at Bletchley Park from July 1941 and started looking after the Cipher Office when there were 9 employees, having only managed one person in his life before, as there was one junior in Barclays Bank. Within 3 years, he was managing 450 people, mainly ladies, in his office, which over a 3-year period is quite an amazing growth, which I think he managed extremely well through his high level of organisation skills and efficiency. He worked particularly on one form of organising and improving efficiency in his department, where the Typex operators were issued each shift with a slip of paper. They had to put their unique number on that slip of paper and the unique number of each message that they had to process. And then they would record the number of 5-letter groups that they worked on throughout their shift. And these slips of paper were gathered together and my grandfather would assimilate the information and work out where there were weaknesses in different shifts so that he could perhaps move some ladies to work in a shift where there was a lot more work to do, and perhaps where some of the girls needed extra training because they were sort of falling a bit behind, he would organise extra training for them. And this helped to ensure that there was a very high level of efficiency in his department.
So he's ideally suited, really, from his managerial background to the way Bletchley becomes an intelligence factory and starts to institute what they call these factory methods.
Yes, absolutely, because he was so good at organising everything. And so he did that very successfully.
So we've seen that the Cipher Office, it did work, but it wasn't the nicest place at Bletchley to work, I think it's fair to say. And I can look at the documentation that we see in the archives and point to all these problems, but I think you would agree, it's easy in these situations to be quite unfair to the people involved. And we must be very careful not to judge them too harshly for the situation they find themselves in. So, Caroline, how do you explain the fact that the Cipher Office has these morale problems and these problems retaining staff? And how do we reconcile that with the fact that Mr. White was clearly very capable at doing his job?
Well, there certainly were a large number of areas where the conditions were very poor for the Typex operators. Certainly where they worked, it was hot in summer, cold in winter. The ventilation was very poor. There was talk of there being a heavy atmosphere. The ladies smoked a lot. The rooms were blue with smoke, one of the veterans was quoted as saying. There were so many areas where it was unhealthy. Often they had poor billets. Joan Ireland, one of the veterans, lived on a farm, and the conditions there were appalling. She said that in the morning she would have to break the ice on the water of her washstand before she could have a wash in the morning. And there was no sewage, no water, no heating in her billet. And yet she said she couldn't go to the authorities and ask to be moved to another billet. She just had to get on with it. So the conditions there were bad. Transport to and from accommodation was often not good. She commented on having to walk in the dark sometimes.
You've got this pretty poor living conditions for these young women, and then they're going into the office and it's not a lot better, is it?
Absolutely, with the smoking issue and the noisy machines, they were so noisy, and also handling the Typex machines, they were much harder to handle and press the keys than a normal typewriter. All these things were very difficult and made conditions overall so much harder. The shifts were terrible. They had to do long shifts. Joan Ireland commented on the fact that they were just always tired, and when she had time off, she'd want to catch up on her sleep. She said, "You were always tired. You came off at 4 after a week of days, and then you went on at midnight." And at night time, if there was a sort of a break where they were waiting for another message to come through, she said, "You would put your woolly hat and your scarf and your gloves maybe on the front of the machine and then lean over and go to sleep." Having to deal with the tiredness and the poor conditions at home, as well as in the office, there were a lot of illnesses. A lot of staff were off work. And quite honestly, it wasn't surprising. But in spite of some of these issues, I asked Joan Ireland how she felt when she worked at BP. Was she happy or did she hate it? She said, "Well, I mean, it was sort of routine. You knew what you had to get on with, and you did." And I asked her about other people in the office, whether they had low morale. And she said, "Well, I think we were all sort of all together, much of a muchness. Well, I mean, we weren't exactly happy, you know. People had a long journey to get there, and where we lived wasn't ideal, and what we ate wasn't ideal. You know, I mean, it was a bit like the army or the forces. You just had to get on with it." And this is what I found again and again reading. It was all about stiff upper lip in wartime, that sort of displaying fortitude and stoicism in the face of adversity. They just knew they had to get on with it, and they did.
They really subscribed to the same ideas as the managers, really, in that people in this situation just have to get on with the job.
Exactly. Absolutely. They just had to get on with it. There just seems overall a lot of positivity in spite of all the negativity of the terrible conditions they suffered. So I do feel that perhaps the morale was more related to the work conditions and less to the fact that perhaps the management, including my grandfather, perhaps wasn't always visible.
Well, there's two factors here in sort of mitigation, I suppose, which is firstly that we know a lot of places at Bletchley had very similar problems. And the cipher office, really, it's not unusual in having these problems. Maybe it's a bit of a perfect storm of having bad conditions for the staff, poor pay, bad working environment, pretty dull work. And they're in a situation where they can't be given too much information about what they're doing, which is what we know keeps it interesting for the people doing the crypto work or the intelligence work. And of course, the other point is that it does work. I mean, your grandfather does get the section working at a high level of efficiency and they get the job done. And at the end of the day, there's a war on. And you can't let anything slow down the pace of the work or damage the efficiency of the operation. You've got to get the work done or it's going to have bad consequences.
Exactly. And certainly by all accounts, the office did work very efficiently. So I have a testimony from Mary Zelly Payne, who was one of the early members of staff before my grandfather started and was there throughout to the end of the war, as was my grandfather. She said, "He was absolutely magnificent, and he remained to the end of the war. Well, he had everything. He was a very clever man. His experience as a bank manager, of course, was very useful in administrating what became an enormous section. The whole thing worked out very well after that. So this shows that obviously people that knew him really appreciated what he was doing. And also, when my grandfather finally left Bletchley Park in January 1946, when a lot of the ladies had already left, he was presented with a leather wallet from some of the remaining staff, and he kept the note, which I still have, so it obviously meant a lot to him. And they wrote, "Mr. A.S. White, on the occasion of your departure from BP, we would like you to accept this small token of our respect and esteem. We regret that we are unable to give the wallet a better start in life, financially speaking, but we trust that this will be the only occasion on which it is so low in funds. We hope that our present will remind you, when you are once more back in a predominantly male atmosphere, of the girls who worked in your section at BP, and that you will think favourably, and dare we hope regretfully, of the days when your staff was overwhelmingly feminine. We are all sorry to say goodbye to you, but wish you every success and happiness for the future. Your staff."
We know your grandfather was very well thought of by the management as well, the real top management, Edward Travis, because you have this reference which Travis wrote for him when he left Bletchley Park.
Yes, I do. I have it here. "Mr. A.S. White is leaving us shortly, and I think you should know how well he has done during his 5.5 years with us. He has from the start been in charge of a communications department, and we have all constantly depended on the accuracy and speed of its work. The department was White's creation, if not in conception, and it grew from small beginnings and a staff of 9 into an organisation employing 450 people in September 1944. Since July 1941, when White first took charge, I cannot remember one occasion on which the department has failed to produce service of the very highest quality. We are all sorry to lose him and wish him the best of luck in the future. E.W. Travis." So again, that illustrates how well thought of he was at Bletchley Park.
Caroline, just to finish off, can you tell us a bit about what you do as a volunteer at Bletchley Park and what Bletchley Park means to you?
Yes, Bletchley Park means a lot to me, obviously primarily because of my grandfather working here. I'm obviously very proud of the fact that he worked here, and I wanted to become part of Bletchley and help in a very small way. I do 2 roles of volunteering. I assist with the role of honour, which is on the website. The second role is stewarding, where I assist by guiding people in the different sections and answer questions. I'm learning all the time because there's a never-ending amount of information to learn, but I really enjoy working there and learning more about Bletchley.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
There's all this material moving around. There's intercepts in high-speed Morse, there's translated Morse, plain text, ciphertext, in, out. And this is all within Bletchley Park alone. How did they move it and how did they keep track of all of this?
Okay, so it's all moving between different parts of the park by various methods, most basic being runners. You have girls again, messenger girls, some as young as 14, but most is probably a bit older, who are taking messages physically from place to place. A lot of the internal correspondence seems to pass that way. You've obviously got a telephone system, which is its own story, people running that. You've also got conveyor belts and pneumatic tubes for taking the bulk of the message traffic from place to place. And these are all set up in strategic positions around the buildings to connect all the sections together. We don't have a very good picture of how all those systems fit together because it's not run by one group of people. It's every section running its own little bit of the communications picture.
So bits are different in different buildings.
Yeah, and all fitting together in a quite a confusing jigsaw, which I haven't been able to piece together, and I don't think anyone ever will be able to piece together because the records aren't there. Mm-hmm. But we have a good idea of at least the basics of how it worked.
It all sounds like there's different systems moving in different ways with different intersecting methods. Is there an overarching person or team or organisation holding this all together?
Well, eventually there sort of is. There's sort of a central post room, we might call it, which is called the signals office. Mm-hmm. This comes around at quite a late date. If we go back to basics, quite a lot of our listeners will have read the Hut 6 story, Gordon Welshman talking about the process in Hut 6. And he talks about registration, which is when the messages arrive in Hut 6, you have to work out which cipher key a message is enciphered with and sort them into piles before you can start breaking them. Now, this has confused a lot of people because they've extrapolated from this that there is a process at Bletchley where all of the incoming traffic arrives in the same place and then it all needs sorting out. So you kind of get your dispatch riders all come into one room, they make a big pile of intercepts, and then people go through it and work out, well, this is a Japanese naval message and this is a German
air message.
Army message, yeah, whatever. And they all go to the various sections. Most of the time, you don't actually need to do that because, as we've talked about earlier, you simply set up your communication system. So a Y station picking up a particular type of traffic feeds to a particular teleprinter room, which is connected to a particular cryptanalytic section at Bletchley. So you know where the traffic is going. You don't need to bring it all into one central place and then sort it out. However, by 1944, the system is so complicated. There's so much internal traffic in particular that you do need some middlemen or middle women, as inevitably they are. And so you get something called the Central Signals Registry set up. And you talked about logging traffic. They do log all of these communications. They set up these standards in how you address a message, how you number them, because every message needs to have a serial number on it so you can place it. You need to identify the sender. You need to put it in a subject category if it's, you know, if it's a piece of correspondence, so you need to know what it's about and be able to group it in that way. And so you need people checking the traffic to make sure all that identifying information is all correct and to make sure it gets to the right place. They're logging all the traffic as well. They're looking for bottlenecks in the system and making sure traffic is flowing smoothly and it's not getting stuck and held up at any particular point in its way through the system. So that's part of the signals office.
And this signals office is in Block E as well.
Yes, it's in the south wing of Block E. Also in the south wing of Block E is where you have the most interesting job they're doing, which is to do with the main pneumatic tube system.
You love a pneumatic tube.
I do love a pneumatic tube. I think they're very exciting.
As is going to become
clear. As would anyone.
Well, this is true. I mean, pneumatic tubes, they're not really around anymore, but I think a lot of people are quite familiar with them, the sort of drainpipe-sized tubes that have canisters whooshing through them from place to place.
Yeah, and they can whiz a message all the way through from Block A to Block D if you need it in just a minute or two.
Yeah.
And obviously massively beneficial for efficiency.
And also no need to wander into a room where you're not allowed just to deliver something as well.
Absolutely. So you have one main system working out of Block E and a big tube centre, which would have been a room with maybe 30 or 40 tubes all terminating in a line. We know they had at least 29 single tubes and 6 double tubes in this system.
Wow.
So there would have been one person or maybe a few people taking messages out of these and feeding them into different tubes. And this connects everything together. And then in all the outlying blocks, they have their own internal tube systems.
Mm.
So there you would have had people receiving messages from Block E and then looking at the address on it and working out which of their tubes they needed to put the canister in for it to be fed to the right person in that block.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get a really complex system emerging from that based on quite a few people sitting in small offices with a few tubes in front of them. I actually managed to find the instructions that were issued to tube operators in the main tube centre in Block E.
Grey and black containers are to be used for all normal purposes. Zebra containers, which will be passed through the tube centre with extra speed, being used only for very urgent documents. Containers are always to be inserted in the tube with the indicator ring end uppermost. Operators must never send more than one container at a time. Firstly, and most importantly, because it is liable to cause a blockage and lead to either a complete breakdown or serious delays on certain systems. Secondly, because when the operator releases the little door at the centre end of the single tubes, she may receive a very painful blow on the hand if there is more than one container inside the tube. Nothing, unless in a container, may be inserted in the tube, and the system may only be used for official documents. If it is suspected that at any particular terminal point, the tube system is being used for sending anything other than official documents, the matter will be investigated and reported to the head of the section concerned. It is possible either to dispatch or receive containers, but not both simultaneously, on a single tube system. An indicator light system has been provided, whereby the terminal point operator can warn the tube centre operator if it is desired to dispatch a container to the latter and vice versa. For this reason, full attention must be given to the indicator light at all times. When power is required for sending from a terminal point, the light should be switched on and left on until the operator at the centre responds. A continuous flashing does not attract the operator's attention as quickly as a steady glow and is extremely trying. The method of operation of double tubes is simplicity itself, as a succession of containers can be simultaneously dispatched both from tube centre to terminal point and vice versa. When dispatching a container, the only special instruction which must be borne in mind is that not more than one container must be in transit at a time. For this reason, operators on terminal point 2, 3 and 5 must allow an interval of not less than 15 seconds to elapse, while operators on terminal points 1, 4 and 6 are to allow an interval of not less than 60 seconds to elapse between dispatch of one container and the next. The receipt of containers calls for no special instructions. Care must, however, be taken that each incoming container is removed from the receiving basket immediately upon arrival, in order to avoid damage from containers arriving subsequently.
And we have some evidence about what that might have involved with Joyce Begoni, who was one of the teleprinter operators working in and around Block E.
So, Joyce, this is Block E.
Right.
You probably won't recognise it, but I think this was where you worked from, because this was the communications.
Yeah, you're quite right. I remember I used to peek round the back. There was a loo stuck round the back somewhere and things like that. It looks vaguely familiar. No, I tell you what, I think we did work in the concrete block.
And what was it you did?
Well, I was a teleprinter operator, and I've just realised that they'd got all the coded messages over, and they printed it out in written Morse on green paper. Remember that? Then they sent these things to us in written Morse. We translated it into, I think it was five digit things. And it also said in those messages where they needed to go. And we had, it was like a telephone and it was teleprinter because it can't be tapped into. Landline, wasn't it? Yeah. And we sent them out by teleprinter. And sometimes you'd work on the switchboard and you could send a message to five or six RAF stations all over the country, and you could type it out on one teleprinter,
right.
Or if you sent it to one, you know.
And how did the information come into you? How did it arrive in your office?
Anybody remembers the old-fashioned haberdashery stores, and that they used to have this system where you had a little ball and you put it in and pull a thing and it went along wires. So it used to come from the main office in the front, which was manned by men, presumably. Right. To us, and with the lake just in front of there, they took the frogs out of there, used to put it in with a message so that when we got it, we opened it up, a frog jumped out at us. Typical man, wasn't it?
Absolutely brilliant.
Can you give us an example of how these canisters might move around from place to place?
Yeah, so you'd have the main tube system in the middle, in Block E, connected to various parts of Block E, but also to some terminal points in the outlying blocks. And then they'd each have their own internal system, which would send the message on to whoever needed it. So if, for example, the cipher office decipher a message that's addressed to an officer in Hut 3, they'd send it by their tube to the main tube centre, and then the tube operator there would send it on to the tube terminal in Block D, which is where Hut 3 is based.
So confusing.
And then the operator there in their little room would transfer it to one of their tubes in the internal tube system, which would take it to the nearest place, so that officer's office, and then it would pop out of a tube into a basket, and then somebody in that office would look at what the message was and deliver it probably by hand from that point on.
And they're all perfectly labelling this up, following the instructions as they should.
It seems to work most of the time, but no doubt not all the time. But the key thing here is the operators themselves never open the canisters, because of course it's all secure. Mm-hmm. And they're not meant to read what's actually inside. So you close the canister, you have these indicator rings on it, which you can set to a particular number, which tells you where it needs to go, and then you send it off through the system. And all being well, unless somebody makes a mistake, it should get there without anyone having to actually look inside the canister and see what that message actually is.
So you've described the signals office as a kind of central post room. It does sound quite a challenge to keep track of, but really also sounds a little bit dull.
It's a little mundane, isn't it? But an interesting light on it, I suppose, is shone by the fact of who is in charge, a man called Douglas Jones. We encountered him in the previous episode of the podcast, actually, when we were talking about poetry. He's a former translator in Hut Free, but he's known after the war for his role in the theatre. As Douglas Craig, he changes his name from Jones to Craig because he says there are too many Joneses in the theatre. And he goes away and has his career as director of the Sadler's Wells Theatre during the 1970s and rescues it really from collapse. And at Bletchley Park, he's active in music and performance while he's here. And as we talked about in the last podcast, we know he was the one who performed Bumf Palace to the tune of Trees at the VJ Day party right at the end of the war. And so he's quite an interesting, unconventional figure and presumably fairly dramatic and flamboyant, you can imagine. Somebody who loved to perform must have been. He's not a stereotypical bureaucrat, functionary sort of character. And it tells us a lot about Bletchley Park that such a functional part of the system is headed by such an unconventional figure, and an indication that the people at the top, they valued having an intelligent, imaginative head, presumably with quite good people skills, even in a section like the signals office.
Maybe it needs a bit of creative skill to manage all those moving parts.
Yeah, it always helps. And it's still part of Bletchley at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
It's still got that Bletchley vibe.
Let's step back for a second and look at the communication centre, Block E. We've got the auto room, teleprinters, the cipher office, the signals office. How big is this organisation within Bletchley Park in terms of, say, numbers of people?
So the first three of those jobs, they each occupy about 400 people,
mm-hmm.
450 in the case of the cipher office. So they're big sections. They're almost, each of them is almost as big as a Hut 6 or a Hut 3.
Mm-hmm.
The signals office employs a little over 100 people, so a bit smaller. Those are the main four sections. Then you've got all sorts of little ones. You've got a sort of communications HQ. You've got people doing statistics. You've got people running the phone system. You've got engineers. All sorts of smaller teams, which are also important parts of this jigsaw. Overall, at Bletchley Park Communications, when the park's at its peak, with about 9,000 people, it employs about 1,500. So it's about 16% of the organisation.
Mm.
It's a big chunk. And as I say, it's predominantly women, predominantly either in uniform or directed. So they're conscripted in all but name.
And these are younger women as well.
Absolutely.
Am I right that the GPO are also involved in this side of things too? So we're not just talking people in the armed forces, it's civilians brought in by the GPO?
Yeah, there's about 40, 45, 50 GPO engineers keeping everything running. They're playing an important role. So there's a lot of elements in this system. They're all important. They're all indispensable, really. These 1,500 people or so, they're all doing work which is skillful but unstimulating, and they deserve credit for sticking at it despite having no idea what they were really involved with.
Mm.
At the end of the day, without them, Bletchley Park wouldn't have worked.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening. And we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.